Hi, welcome to Interviews with the Masters, brought to you by TheOutdoorInsiders.com, your number one spot for inside information and quality gear. Today we have with us on the phone a good buddy of mine, no other than Tim the Hammer Gillingham. How are you doing today?
Not too bad. How are you doing, John?
Good, man. Getting ready for archery deer season here in Arizona. Started today.
You guys have the longest hunting seasons in the world.
We haven't had archery since our archery season is broken up into three sections. We got that August through September, and then it opens back up now till the end of December, which is the calendar year, and then you have to get another tag for 2017, and you can hunt January 1st to the 31st. So it's kind of long, but it's not really like – it doesn't go straight through from August to January, which
– Yeah, that's pretty cool, though. I like being able to come down there sometimes and get my fix.
Get out of the freezing cold.
That's right.
Come down and hunt in 60 degrees, you know. But, it's nice. It's definitely – I look forward to it because it's my favorite time of year to hunt, and I get to do it at home because by this time my wife is tired of me traveling. So it's nice to, come home, hunt from the house, come home every night and eat dinner with the wife and kids and stuff. So
Shot a nice coos deer down there 2 years ago, I think it was.
Yeah, that was a really good one. And you got it, the second day or something like that?
Oh, no, it was the first day. Come on now.
Oh, it was the first day. That's what it was.
First day, first stock. Isn't that the way it's supposed to go?
Yeah, right? Jesus. Luckiest man alive. Or the best hunter in the world. One of the two.
No, it's just one of those that just kind of worked out.
Yeah, man. I remember that. You were like, oh, isn't this supposed to be hard? Shit. Oh, man. It's actually been a while since I've got a coos deer with my bow. I shot a couple with the rifle in the last few years, but I haven't. Most of my archery deer in the last 10 years have been muleys here. But I have a goal. If I don't score this January, I think I'm going to in the early season. I really want to get a coos buck in velvet.
I got a good one of the guys on my shooting staff down there's killed a couple dandies.
Yeah, there's a couple guys that got them really dialed in that are really like.
Brian Rinza down there.
Oh, Rinza, yeah.
He's got them dialed.
Got a good one.
He killed a couple good ones.
Yep. Yeah, he's got that one this year. That was real nice.
Yeah.
For sure. So I have you on today because I get these questions thrown at me all the time, and see a lot of debate about micro diameter shafts. Versus the standard carbon shaft, and I don't know anybody who knows more about arrows than you, so I'm coming to you to kind of give us, educate us on the two and kind of give us the pros and cons and kind of give us your philosophy on the whole situation. And we're going to gear it towards hunting. Obviously, there's going to be different shafts for shooting target and stuff like that and benefits.
Well, the same principles apply. It's just that, the broadhead has to be fixed to the arrow. So that becomes kind of the big issue when you're dealing with micro diameter shafts. So that in a sense, the average whitetail hunter back east, frankly, in my opinion, is probably better off just shooting an internal component system like our Velocity or our Pro Hunter. I personally think that they're easier to shoot, easier to tune. They present a larger target for the power stroke of the string, meaning I think there's a bigger sweet spot. And one of the analogies I use all the time is I used to work on the railroad, and we used to drive spikes in with a spike ball. And they had two ends on it. One was small, one was large. Now, if you could drive that spike dead in the center with a small end, it would drive it in faster because you're channeling the energy in a smaller area. But if you had ever so slight of a glancing blow, you might as well have used the bigger end that had more surface area coverage. And that's the best analogy that I can give for, large diameter versus small. Now, where small really starts to benefit a shooter And you know, this is especially true in target archery, is the smaller diameter simply has less surface area. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Now, a lot of people look at wind drift in arrows in terms of it's just pure side profile, the wind's pushing the whole arrow. That's not necessarily the case. And
mm-hmm.
what's really happening is when the wind hits the back of the arrow, you're basically pushing the arrow sideways, and then you're creating a planing surface, okay? And the larger that planing surface is, the faster it's going to take off, a.k.a. mechanical broadheads versus fixed-blade broadheads. When the fixed-blade broadhead gets sideways, it takes off.
Right.
And there's ways of counteracting that, number one being, you know, point weight. You know, we have a weight system for all of our arrows that you can put in behind the shafts. If you deal with our Pierce and our Kinetic shafts, which are our smaller diameter, you know, arrows, they already have insert systems that are, you know, upwards of 40 grains. So you don't necessarily need any extra weight, but
right.
weight up front is really going to kind of resist that, you know, that planing. The bigger that arrow is when it gets sideways, we take a big diameter, you know, arrow like, say, an X-Cutter. I've actually hunted with an X-Cutter. It's a very popular 3D shaft. And
right.
and as long as I have enough point weight up front, man, that baby will shoot awesome out to, you know, 80, 90 yards. But then it starts to deteriorate as it, you know, the bigger the diameter of the arrow is, also it also slows down quicker. The faster an arrow slows down, the more susceptible it is to wind drift.
Right.
The big kicker, again, with, you know, with small diameter arrows is how are you going to fixture the broadhead to it? And there's several different types of insert systems that you can use. You know, our Pierce has been a super popular arrow this year.
That's what I'm saying.
You just used it to take a nice desert bighorn. I mean, mm-hmm. once people understand how it's a pretty good system. I mean, it's a two-part system that, you know, you have a – you can't really fit – unless you use a deep six broadhead, you can't really fit the ferrule of the broadhead down inside of that shaft. It's just not big enough. So,
right.
you know, you basically have the entire broadhead out in front of the shaft. So you have to figure out ways to shore that up. So, you know, there's a lot of leverage on that, you know, wanting to bend it and wanting to knock it out of center. And so I think the system that we came up with is exceptionally good. There is some expertise required on, and this is any bow hunter, learning how to spin tune broadheads. You know, if a guy goes to our Aero University section on our website, there's a section on broadhead tuning, and I'm going to try to do a video on it and add it to our YouTube link on our website too. You know, to kind of give guys a better idea. I was lucked out and was taught that when I was 13 years old. And it's just simply, you know, there's play in the ferrule of the broadhead, you know, and the threads. And you basically are just trying to get the point, the point of the broadhead, dead center in the axis of rotation, so that when you spin it, it runs perfectly straight and it's not wobbling. So,
okay. Makes sense.
And you do that simply by putting it on a spinner, putting the tip up against something, and then just pushing it around until you get it dead perfect. And it's smart to mark it with a Sharpie or something, so you know if you're pushing too hard, pushing too soft. Now, there's other systems. You know, Victory uses a what we call a tree pan cut insert. It's a single piece tree pan cut. So, or they use a full outsert. The full outsert's not very popular. Guys damage a lot of arrows. You know, there's a lot of leverage out there. So, you know, you're putting it on a little 0.166 diameter shank, and it's going to bend if it hits anything hard. So, to counteract that, you know, you can machine the inside of the insert to slip back over the shaft a little bit. That's in a very, very expensive process.
Okay.
The other option is a deep six option, but that requires you to shoot deep six broadheads. And I've actually myself personally ran the deep six Easton in the Pierce. That's another option. One of the cool things about the Pierce is they have a knock collar. When I did do that, I actually put the knock collar on the point end, because the problem with a hidden insert style system is your end of your shaft is real susceptible to damage.
Right.
But by putting that knock collar over the end, I mean, you're able to do that. But again, that requires
like
a deep
plate.
Six. Yeah. It just requires a deep six broadhead to shoot. And I've shot the NAP kill zones in a deep six. I mean, it's a good head. I really don't have any complaints with it. But I'm always looking for the most streamlined heads, have the least amount of blading surface in them, because those are the characteristics that are going to cause, you know, planing and accuracy issues, especially the further downrange that you get. So.
Right.
But
now,
you know,
I got a question. So now this is just a rudimentary test that I did when I first got my platinum pierces. I just got a brand spanking new block target shipped to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I shot those out of the same bow, versus what I was shooting before, which was the Hunter Pros.
Mm-hmm.
And I was getting like 4 or 5 inches more penetration, same broadhead, same weight, total weight of the arrow, well, you know, within 2 or 3 grains of each other.
Yeah.
And is that just simply because of friction,
well,
more surface friction,
well,
or is it actually hitting harder?
Well, we did a test a few years back when we were doing a video, and I took the same thing, a brand new block target, and we took a full metal jacket, and we took a Pro Hunter. The Pro Hunter actually out-penetrated, at least matched or out-penetrated the full metal jacket every time.
Mm-hmm.
Now, keep in mind, the full metal jacket is a straight shaft. It has an internal component system, so you have that same level of friction all the way. With a pierce, you have a bigger insert and no drag from behind it. So that's probably what's happening. You're getting no drag behind it. That does apply in a hunting situation. Oh. When I was shooting X cutters, I think. Are you there?
I lost you. I got no drag, and then you went silent for a bit.
Maybe I had my fingers over the phone or something. But okay, so basically, when you have a smaller arrow, you have, like a pierce that has a bigger insert out front. You know, same thing with the broadhead. You're cutting a hole in front of the shaft. You have less drag behind it. Now, the skinnier that shaft is, the less drag you're going to have going through the wound channel. You know, when I was hunting with X cutters, I do feel like the X cutter did kind of slow down going through the animal a little bit faster, although I shot completely through several animals with that particular arrow. I shot an elk down in Arizona that year, or actually it was in New Mexico, and I actually went through and hit the opposite rib on the other side. It literally hit the rib, and it seemed like it almost just bounced back.
Okay.
I mean, the thing didn't make it 100 yards, but again, it looked to me like I got no penetration, you know, when I did that. So,
right.
But I think that's what happened. But there is some logic behind that, but I think at some point people are splitting hairs. I mean, I've shot completely through deer, you know, with mechanical broadheads at, you know, distances well over 100 yards with a 380 grain arrow in a velocity. So
wow.
Most of it's shot placement, you know, and if you bow hunt long enough, you're going to make a shot that, you know, didn't go where you wanted to. I mean, I had one this year at 42 yards. I shot a mule deer buck kind of quarter facing me, and I mean, I thought it was close enough I could thread it in there, and I must have hit the ball sock, and I'm shooting 112 foot-pounds of energy. And I'll argue with anybody, it's all shot placement.
Yeah.
You know, I never got that deer. I mean, he bled for 200 yards and he was gone. I mean, and I just don't think it hit anything vital. I think it hit right in the ball socket of the shoulder.
Yeah.
So
I shot a bull elk this year at 82 yards, hit him a little high. And that's why the track job was a little bit longer and further than I.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
But the broadhead, basically, the arrow didn't go all the way through, but the broadhead poked out the other side. Like me, I didn't get a clean pass through. I thought that was 82 yards on an elk. I thought, you know, there's something too, maybe something to the fact that, you know, it's shooting a micro shaft, because I've made that same or similar distance shot, and now hearing you saying it, that the hole is bigger going through, and you're not, you know, there's less friction of the shaft going through after the fact. But I made that same shot with my pros, and I got great penetration, but it never poked out the other side.
But problem is people want to compare penetration. They've shot a handful of animals, and you shot two animals in the same. So-called the same spot, but they didn't hit the same stuff.
Yeah,
so it's really hard to make that. It's super hard to make that assessment. My buddy that was hunting with me in Nebraska this year, he shot a deer 75 yards, 400 spine. I think he shot 400 or 340 of the pierces, and he blew right through it.
Yeah.
You know, again, we didn't know what he swears he smoked it, and you know, it only went 115 yards, but man, that it was hit high in the lungs, and it didn't bleed much outside of the body cavity, so it
yeah.
was a little tricky. But we found him. You know, we found him the same. You know, we were thinking we're going to have to come back in the morning, and we ended up stumbling into him. So, but it's again, in terms of penetration. You know, my criteria, number one is shot placement. Number two is broadhead design. Number three is arrow flight. And then diameter and weight are down the list. I do think when you pack a little bit more of the weight up front, like you do with the Velocity or with the Pierce and the Kineticus, you are getting that smaller, heavier portion through the animal faster. Okay.
Right.
I mean, I think it does have a marginal penetration, you know. It's just like a framing hammer, okay? If you got a wood handle and a heavy head, it's going to drive the nail in faster. It's the same principle. But I think a lot of times you actually get better penetration at distance simply because the arrow is flying so perfectly straight that it's channeling all its energy dead down the center, just like that spike ball, you know, analogy.
Right.
We set a target up here at Bowcast one year, and it was a long distance, 115, 20-yard shot, and guys were shooting clay pigeons off of it. And I'm telling you what, it was a bear to get target arrows out of that target. And you'd think you'd be able to walk up and just pull them out, but they were tough.
Oh, yeah.
And
oh, yeah.
So, but I think people should just pick arrows based on, you know, kind of what they're doing. I always pick them based on what speed I want to run. That's really my criteria. I'm a long draw length, so, you know, we don't really make – you know, the only arrows that I can get, I need a 250 spine with the poundage I shoot at a very, very minimum. I really want a 200 spine, so a lot of times I'll use a Chaos 200 as I run 75 pounds. I see a lot of hunters using too weak arrows, and that's probably, you know, with broadheads, one of the worst things that you can do.
So how does a guy really shoot? I mean, I know there's charts and stuff, but how do you know, like, okay, so my chart, for me, for my bow and my draw length or whatever, says 340, you know, as a spine. In
sure.
Or excuse me, says 300 as a spine. But for some reason, two of my bows shoot really much better with 340s, and one of my bows shoots really good with 300. So I mean, aside from buying a half a dozen and seeing how they shoot for you, is there any way to kind of?
Yeah, I think there's a couple misnomers there, right? You're saying your bow, you know, everybody tells me my bow likes this arrow. Well, bows don't like arrows. Bows
yeah.
either have crappy knock travel or they don't.
Okay.
And if you're driving the power stroke of the string down the center of the arrow, you can shoot virtually anything you want. You know, that's why I love bows with yoke systems. The PSEs I'm shooting now, they have yoke systems. They're very tunable. Bowtech is probably the best bow on the market far as pure level knock travel, because you got twin yoke systems, you got a flex guard system, you got binary cam systems, so everything is equal, you know. So it's very, very manipulable system. When you start getting into systems that don't have yokes and you've done everything, you know, the only thing you got to do is move the arrow rest left or right for a tune, it can be very difficult sometimes to tune these bows. And then a guy puts a weaker spined arrow in and it shoots a bullet hole through paper, so you know, that bow likes that arrow better than the other. And it's not necessarily the case. It's just basically bending the arrow around the problem in the bow. What you're going to run into, though, is, you know, you're going to see when my biggest criteria to determine whether an arrow is too weak or, you know, is simply how consistent do they react through paper. Okay, so I shoot all my arrows. This is the number one tip I can give any bow hunter, any target archer. This is the number one tip. Shoot all your arrows in. They're not created equal. Okay. Now, I'm a long draw guy. I'm sure I see it more than anybody else. I'm sure the 28-inch draw length archer can get away with murder compared to what I can. Or, you know, but, you know, as bows get higher performance, you know, we have a tune chart that reflects two different speed ratings on bows. And, you know, one's just kind of a performance, one's kind of, you know, middle of the road. So that people have to apply the fact that this bow is actually high performance into the scenario. But if you'll go shoot all your arrows through paper at 5 yards and they all react exactly the same, they're basically going to shoot in the same arrow hole.
Right.
If they're too weak, you're going to get a variety of tears. It's going to be very difficult to rotate knocks and get them to tune in. Now, if you have arrows that don't rip exactly the same, you can rotate to the next vein. I shoot four fletch patterns. In fact, Gold Tip this year, we actually are offering factory fletched four fletch arrows. It's the first company ever to do that. I'm really excited about the fact that, you know, our pro hunters are velocity pros. We have a new a Valkyrie shaft coming out. Good looking shaft that will come, you know, four fletch too. But four fletch allows me four vein rotations, you know, after I fletched it. And usually, even if I'm pushing an arrow really hard, which for me, a 250 spine, I'm pushing pretty hard, I usually have to rotate and find this. I shoot every arrow on all four vein positions, and I pick the very, very best. And that's where I learned this in applying this from paper to a shooting machine. And I pretty much do that exclusively for my target archery. Where I learned this was shooting broadheads. Mm-hmm. You know, I realized that when I had a little bit of a left tear, you know, in my bows, my broadheads were impacting, especially fixed blades, you know, 18, 20 inches to the right at 80, 90 yards.
Wow.
So when I'm shooting all my arrows through paper, I'm realizing, well, if I got a left tear here and it's shooting over there, what happens when I got a high tear and a right tear? And so, you know, through process of elimination, you know, have simply come to understand that the most important factor is that every single arrow shoots exactly the same. Now, with beginning archers and beginning hunters, sometimes even guys have been doing it a while, it can be pretty difficult, you know, if a guy's not competing and shooting all the time, to develop the kind of form that it takes to be repetitive. So if you can't shoot the same arrow twice through paper, it doesn't do any good to shoot all your arrows, is what I'm trying to, you know, say.
Gotcha.
So one of the best tuning things there, or training aids you can do, is get a guy in front of paper and have him shoot and work on his grip and work on his form until he can, you know, duplicate that over and over and over and over again. Okay. Because that's the true tell. And when you get under the gun, I mean, I'm as experienced as they get as far as being under the gun, and, man, I still get rattled on animals.
Yeah. I mean, the long and short of it is all this equipment out there that we have, all the bows, all the arrows, everything is far more precise than we are. It's all about the input going into it, really.
Yes, but there's ways of building forgiveness into a system. By putting point weight on, by adding more fletching to the rear, we can counteract some of those mistakes much, much quicker. You know, having perfect clearance with a good drop away rest. You know, things like that. You know, we can create a scenario where that archer that has a more difficult time shooting every arrow consistent, or when we're under the gun and nervous and out of position, and that string may not hit the arrow exactly the same. The way we configure the arrow is going to, you know, make it more forgiving in the long run. And I think people see that with smaller diameter arrows because you have less surface area. You know, it'd be the same as shooting a mechanical versus a fixed blade. You have less surface area on the shaft, so when that shaft does get sideways, it doesn't have as big a planing surface. So, therefore, it's not going to want to plane off as much as, say, a bigger shaft in the same scenario.
Makes sense.
Yeah, that's it in a nutshell, and that's target archery. You know, when you're standing there on a line shooting in the wind at, you know, I don't care. You know, I was shooting a tournament in Wales last year, and it was nasty, let me tell you. I was shooting a 480-grain arrow at 295 foot a second. I mean, about as good a wind setup as you can get with a 160-grain point. And I'm still at 55 yards, you know, drifting a foot.
Wow.
You know, so in those scenarios, I mean, a lot of it comes, you know, in those scenarios, a lot of it has the archer, but you – you know, when you can, you know, the reasons I shoot 75 pounds for hunting is so that I can build my arrow weights up and my point weights up in my arrows so that I can make those setups where when I do get those wind shots that my distance of left or right wind drift is a lot less, so it's more calculable.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so, and that's, you know, I've made some pretty hellacious shots in wind that, you know, you had never been able to make with a 350 or, you know, 390-grain arrow just simply because it would have moved twice, the distance left to right.
Yeah, I typically, most of my arrow setups have been over the last, I don't know, 10 years or so, probably been right around that 420 mark total weight. And I feel like it's kind of been the best combination of speed and stability so to speak.
Yeah. I like to stay over 300, you know, with mechanical broadheads. With fixed blades, you know, you can, you know, I think you don't want to really go over 290.
Yeah.
But.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right about where, you know, right about where my shot is. I mean, my speed setup is right there, right at the 300 mark. I'm a 29-inch draw, so I don't have a terribly long draw, but I'm not terribly short either. Just kind of like in that. You know, that one, that spot where you can still get some speed out of these bows that are,
sure,
you know. But, yeah, I learned a lot of that from hunting in Wyoming, and Wyoming and South Dakota is always freaking, if it's not blowing 25 miles an hour,
I grew up in Southwest Wyoming.
it's worked out good for me, and, you know, I've made some pretty long shots, in windy days too, and I can see, you know, I did it not knowing that I was doing it, you know, by choosing a slightly heavier arrow setup and so on and so forth.
Sure.
Heavy
arrows just, you know, they don't lose their energy as fast, you know, they're just not slowed down as quickly as, you know, primarily, you know, which means they retain, just like bullets, they retain their,
yeah.
You know, it's just pure physics. You know, they retain their velocity and their momentum.
Right.
So, and that's going to fight the wind, and it's also going to help penetration, you know, at distance. But, you know, you can shoot completely through animals with proper shot placement. You know, people always want to blow through shoulders. And I mean, I'm shooting the high end of the food chain in energy, and I tell you, you hit them wrong, you're not going through, and that's all there is to it.
No. That's for sure, especially not an elk.
A mule deer, because a lot of times those animals are absorbing that energy. They're moving. It's like it'd be a little similar to shooting a target that was kind of like swinging. You know, if it's swinging or if it's fixtured on all four corners, there's going to be a monstrous difference in the amount of penetration you get. If that thing is going to move when it hits, it's going to absorb energy.
Yep.
So
absolutely. It's like catching an egg.
Yeah.
You know,
now, if that deer are going to, you know, I just, a buddy of mine, we went to Nebraska 2 years ago, and we stalked this nice whitetail buck. It was like the most perfect thing. This coyote come up the ridge, bumped him right to us. He turned around and looked at the coyote, just stretched his old side out, you know, reaching around, looking at that coyote. And I thought, man, that's like the pumpkin shot. And my buddy missed. Of course. I was just like 150-inch, 10-point.
Sometimes when it's too perfect, it gets you flustered.
Welcome to bow hunting. You know, it's still harder. The hardest thing in the world, I don't care how good the equipment gets, it's still extremely difficult inside of 100 yards to range an animal, especially on the ground spot in stock, to range him, get, you know, move your sight or you know, and make the shot. It really is. I mean, it's not easy. I mean, that's why, you know, whitetail hunters do so well out of tree stands. They control that movement and you know, they're a little bit better at, you know, controlling the environment, which, you know, where we hunt out here a lot, it's just running and gunning. You know, I'm just my nature, too. I just have a little wanderlust in me. I can't sit still.
Yeah. I know the feeling.
I got to see what's over the next hill, you know.
So I was just, I just did a podcast earlier this morning with, Dan Liss, Longbow Dan, he had mentioned to me that he had a conversation with you about node tuning, which has been presented to me a couple times, been asked me, and I have no clue what the heck it is. So I don't know what to tell you, buddy. I hand my bow to Daniel or Tony at the archery shop, and I tell them to fix it, and they give it back to me, and I go and shoot something. So
Dan's a good guy, very, very you know, really, really wants to learn everything there is to know about, you know, bows and arrows, you know, and very eager to learn. Nodal tuning is coming kind of from one particular, you know, guy in the tournament industry, and I personally don't think that it matters. And the average bow hunter and even the guys at my level I don't worry about it one bit. I cut all my arrows to the rest because I want the rest to control the point. The further out you put the point from the rest has less control over the point.
Right.
Where nodal tuning makes a little bit more sense is with recurve shooters, okay? And what it's kind of doing is you're finding the vibration point on the shaft, which is typically 3 or 4 inches back from the point. But it makes no sense with a compound bow and release, because a compound bow has to travel several inches before it hits the peak of the draw force curve. Whereas in a recurve, you are loading the arrow up instantaneously with the full load.
Right.
So it makes a little bit more sense in that regard. You know, I would have to talk to some of my buddies like Brady Ellison on the Olympic team to get his take on it. You know, I mean, I'm sure I don't know how much they particularly play with it. Sometimes you hear stuff like this thrown around just because it gives a guy a sense of uniqueness. He must know something that I don't know. And, you know, I don't subscribe to it at all. Every time I leave my arrows long, they shoot worse. And I'll tell you where I learned that. A few years back, people started coming out with a thing called, and this is something that your viewer, you know, your listeners probably want to pay attention to, and this is called torque tuning.
Mm-hmm.
Torque tuning is real, okay? What torque tuning refers to is when a guy torques a bow, you move the sight one way, and you're moving the arrow the other way. And so what we're trying to do is we're trying to move the sight or the rest to where there's a point where they're at where they kind of cancel each other out. And what I've found is I use an overdraw for everything, so the further back I move my rest, the further in my sight's got to go. And the simple way to test that is to simply grab the bow, twist it one way, put the pin in the middle and shoot the shot, grab it the other way, twist it, put the pin in the middle, shoot the shot, and see how much lateral left and right spread you got. And that really applies in a bow hunting scenario and shooting in the wind. That stuff really works. And that's where I learned that leaving the arrows further out in front of the rest didn't work as well.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I can shoot a full overdraw. I shoot a 28.5-inch shaft on a 33.5-inch draw length for everything.
Oh, wow.
We're talking for indoor high-level competition, all my target archery, all my bow hunting. Now, that requires me to bring my sight in. Now, you can move the rest around and adjust it, or you can move the sight around and adjust it, depending on what options you have available to you.
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes you want to keep bow hunting a little simple, more simple. That's another reason why, you know, especially bow hunting bows that are high let off, low brace heights, you know, that's why a 7-inch brace height bow shoots better than a 6.5-inch bow. It's because it has less leverage to be able to torque things left and right. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
If you never torque the bow, then torque tuning doesn't matter. But, you know, if
right.
you're standing out in the wind and it's buffeting you back and forth and your riser's just whipping back and forth, there's an advantage to having that pivot point dead perfect. When you get it off, I've had it off to where at 70 yards, I would miss an entire 4x4 block target.
Yeah.
And when I get it on, I could put them all in the 10 ring.
Right.
No matter how hard I torque it left or right. It's the craziest thing you've ever experience. It's like you wouldn't think it's possible, but that's a very very active, you know, and very, you know, in, you know, tip that people need to really kind of pay attention to. So
I talked to my bow shooting the sheep. Luckily I was close enough that it didn't matter
mm-hmm.
too much.
Sure.
I drew back, and I happened to, like, I made it a habit in hunting to, like, take a quick glance at especially when I'm spotting and stalking. I looked down and I knew my cam was going to hit the rock in front of me because I was just peering over this boulder to shoot him.
Sure.
And so I kind of manhandled the bow a little bit so that when I let go or when I, you know, hit the release, my cam wasn't going to hit the rock. And
sure.
I hit him. I mean, he was quartering the leg slightly. And I was, the shot was only 44 yards, but I hit him pretty much, basically I hit him at the base of the neck. And, I mean, he only went 10 yards and piled up, thank God. But, you know, I guess from my point of where I was aiming to where it hit at 44 yards, which is typically, you know, that's not a very long shot at all. You know, that was 10 inches.
Yeah,
So I'm
well,
not going to manhandle the shit out of it.
well, you could either be manhandling it, or you simply could not have your bow level. This, you know, I would encourage guys to go to hamskyarchery.com. You know, one of the first patents I ever got in archery was for a Hamsky third axis leveling tool.
Mm-hmm.
You need to understand third axis leveling. If your third axis leveling is off, it can cause massive impact shifts left and right, especially with low brace height, high let off bows that are very, you know, torqueable. When you torque the bow, you're moving the third axis. If your third axis is a bubble off, a full bubble off, and I've seen them that or more, you're talking, you know, 7 inches at 60, 70 yards. I mean, it's a big deal. And then when you start applying all the other things like wind and I'm not comfortable. I mean, you draw it on an animal sometimes and you think, what is my sight's not even close to level. You know,
right.
And if you force that bow to level, you know, there's target archery teaches things that the average bow hunter can definitely benefit from. I mean, I learned more from my hunting skills training for these European Pro Series archery circuits than I have doing anything I have ever done. Because it's steep and deep, you know.
Yeah.
When I got in up and downhill shots, when I got over 15, 20 degrees, I realized that I'm hitting right no matter what I do with an index finger release.
Right.
When I was shooting a handheld, I would hit, I can't remember which way it was. I think I would hit dead down the middle uphill, and then downhill I would hit to the right. And what it is, you're just simply getting out of position and your body is coming out of alignment, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And so in order to be able to make these kinds of shots, make those kind of assessments, so this tournament I won in Wales, I mean, I just aimed left side of the dot every single shot that had any, you know, position. I protected the dot, but, I mean, it's just, and as much as I know about it, I know my sights are perfectly level, because if my sights weren't level, it would hit one side uphill and one side downhill. When it was hitting right, you know, it was hitting right both ways, that just simply tells me that I was not getting in alignment. You know, and maybe I shoot too stretched out of a draw length that when I get out of position, it's hard for me to get those pressures, you know, lined up.
Right.
And maybe a higher let-off bow in that scenario would actually shoot better because it's easier to stay in alignment. I don't know. I mean, those are just things that, you know, that you have to get out and put yourself in those scenarios.
I tell people all the time, you got to practice lifelike scenarios. If you're going to be hunting in canyon country. And, you know, I had that problem this year. So I got my new bow, my Halon 6 that I'm shooting, and I really did not shoot, not even an eighth of what I normally shoot in a year. My wife and I had another child, and business was crazy this year, and so I just didn't have the time that I normally would. So, like, leading up to my Ibex hunt last year, I mean, I was shooting just super steep stuff. I was shooting, you know, fast and moving stuff. I was shooting in everything that I could think of that I was going to, you know, encounter on that hunt. I was practicing it. And, but I was shooting an old bow too that I had a lot of experience with, my Helium. And, so I moved to this bow. My very first hunt this year, July, was blacktail hunting in California, and first morning I get on a stud buck. You know, he's probably 140, good 4x4, and I sneak right up on him. I got him bedded at 72 yards, and I'm just waiting for him to stand, and I'm waiting and I'm waiting, but I'm sitting down like Indian style, and it's a pretty steep angle downhill shot. And it's not something I practiced with this bow, and I whiffed it.
Shoot over the top?
I whiffed it. Yep.
Let me tell you why.
I shot right under him.
Under him?
Yes.
Oh, that's usually odd.
And I thought it was, and this is the only thing that I can come up with. But now hearing you say that, maybe it was something about alignment, but I thought I ranged him wrong because I kept ranging the grass or I kept ranging where he was, but the grass was so tall that
that's
I felt like maybe I was hitting in front of him and not actually hitting him.
Mm-hmm.
But now hearing you say this about the alignment and all that stuff, it's like, well, maybe I was just out of alignment. Now, I shoot that Bow IQ sight, which has a retina lock in it, usually tells me when I'm out of alignment for the most part. And
I'm not a super fan of that, just simply because I think it can create target panic issues because you're trying to focus on too many different things. But I think what you brought up, one thing that I think is really what really happens a lot, and it's happened to me too, is misranging animals.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things when you're trying to peek up over a hill and something and range something, a lot of times you'll have a hard time ranging, and that's because the laser is on the lower side of the actual rangefinder. If a guy will flip your rangefinder sideways and range them that way, you can avoid getting too high and still get a range. I had one of the Ultimate Predator decoys this year, and I was trying to range through the thing, and I wasn't able to get it range. I kept hitting the laser, must have kept hitting the material.
Right.
So, but anyway, another thing too, when you're dealing with Western bow hunting, especially in up and down hills like your Ibex and things like that, you really got to learn how to adjust your rangefinder. The rangefinders all cut with a cosine function, okay? So they cut angle with a cosine function. Training for this pro series, and the reason I think that I've done so well at them and won my first one last year was my cuts are perfect. But the only reason they're perfect is I basically went and shot in my cut charts for my bow at that speed. And speed is 100%, just like with a rifle. It's more critical with a bow because it's so much more. The arcs all change, based on speed.
Right.
But the cosine function in a rangefinder is not that accurate. And the steeper you go, the worse off it is. Yeah. You are going to hit high on downhill, and you are going to hit low on uphills from what the rangefinder cuts are going to say. Now, the slower you go, say you're down around 280s, I think you might have a little bit bigger window. The more it matches, the more the arrow arc matches that cosine curve, the better off you are. But what I found in my charts is that only one point in the actual curve was the cosine correct. So only at one yardage was it correct. And it can be as much as I had a mule deer up on the Wasatch Front here 2 years ago. Big buck, 7x11. My buddy saw it the next day and videoed it. And I just knew it was a big buck when I shot. And I was on another buck, and I was had him pinned at 54 yards just waiting for him to clear a brush, and I was going to grease him. I have a cut chart on my arm guard that kind of gives me a percentage cut off my rangefinder. Had it all figured out, all the time in the world. And then all of a sudden, this buck just comes out below him, and I stop him, and the rangefinder says 81. It's 36, 37 degrees downhill, so it's a brute of a shot. And I remember setting the sight, drawing, and thinking, and I just shot him for what the rangefinder said. And I heard arrow hit, and I thought I greased him. But, he's shooting fast sometimes. It's just really hard to see the arrows fly and in the daylight and the snow and stuff. And I got around a corner, and I seen blood all over in the snow, and I seen a deer going underneath this pine. And I thought, I was 100% focused on where that deer went in the pine, thinking it was him. And it turns out when I blood trailed him later, he was standing just down the hill from that blood spot in the snow. And I had hit him right through the top of the back,
Ooh.
I mean, legitimately off the rangefinder on that shot, I should have cut around 5 or 6 yards. I gave some of that information to Levi Morgan last year before he went on his sheep hunt, and he used it. I mean, he went out and applied it, and he used it, and he ended up shooting his tall sheep almost exactly at one of the shots I set up down here, which is 75 yards, 39 degree slope. I think he shot it at somewhere around there at 38 or something like that, and he ended up cutting because he was shooting faster, he ended up cutting, I think, something like 6 yards off it and just drained it.
Wow.
And that's hard, if you don't realize that, you're just going to shoot what the rangefinder says. And then a lot of times in a hunting situation, guys don't really realize why they missed. They trust technology way too much. And,
I had a situation kind of like that. So I got drawn for Ibex again this year.
How do you do that?
Well,
you guys need to have the out-of-state gifting program.
The cat's out of the bag. If you put in with an outfitter,
uh-huh.
Your chances of drawing that tag go way the hell up.
Way oh, really? Up.
From single digits to like 35%, 30-35%.
As a non-resident?
As a non-resident.
Wow.
So, yeah, as a non-resident, if you're putting in without an outfitter, you are looking at like a 3% chance of drawing. It took me 9 years to draw the first time, just to give you an idea. And they don't have a point system, so you're in the hat like everybody else, the same every year.
They just give a certain amount of tags to outfitters.
It's 16 tags total for out of state, and this is not the exact numbers, but I'm giving you it's like 16 tags for out of state, and like I want to say 11 of those tags go to people who are with outfitters, and 5. Are
holy cow. True.
So 3,500 people are putting in, only 250 of them are putting in with an outfitter. You're putting in 250 for 11 tags, and 3,000 people or whatever are putting in for 5 tags, you know? So,
wow.
Yeah. It's a big advantage. So
what's that outfitted hunt run?
It's freaking expensive as shit. It's like 65 to 7,000,
oh,
something
my
like that.
Goodness.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, well.
Luckily, I have a friend there, so I didn't have to, you know, I used his number, and they legally only have to hunt with you for 2 days.
Uh-huh.
So I, you know, I skirted the system
cool.
a little bit.
Yeah, it seems like a pretty cool hunt.
Yeah. Yeah, it's an excellent hunt. So it's probably actually one of my favorites. It is my favorite right now. I think if I could hunt them every year, I would, because they're so challenging and it's such a cool experience.
Hmm.
So I was faced with a shot. My rangefinder was telling me 38 yards. The line of sight was 92 yards.
Holy cow.
Yeah. Those are the kind of shots that you get there. It's basically a tree stand shot of a deer right underneath you.
That's a tricky. The problem you're going to have in a situation like that is your alignment. How do you even make that shot? I mean, it's like, you're not going to have any gravitational pull on your arrow rest. You know, that those type of things start to come into play big time on shots like that.
Yeah.
You'd have to go practice stuff like that just to be able to.
I did. I did last year before my hunt last year. I practiced all that. I was shooting 100 yards.
65 degree.
Yeah, crazy.
65 degree slope?
Mm-hmm.
How do you even make that shot?
You do a little sign of the cross before you send it, and you send it. But
I would have to have a rope on me. Mm-hmm.
I hit left to right was perfect. I hit right at his feet, basically. You know, just inside the pocket of his shoulder. Hit right at his feet, and sparks went flying. But the other thing that was, and I didn't take this into account, and I think if I would have thought about it, took an extra second to think about it, but you don't really get that time with Ibex, because they're never standing still long enough for you to really, like, you can't shoot movable sight. It's like, by the time you reach up to do that, you're busted. They're gone. So the wind was blowing straight at me, straight in my face, hard.
Oh, yeah. That
30 miles an hour, probably. So mm-hmm. It was hitting that arrow, the whole length of that arrow, pushing it down, you know, basically towards the mountain the whole way down, 92
right.
yards of that.
Yep.
So I hit low, and I was like, son of a bitch. And I like, it dawned on me right there. I'm like, well, shit, I should have shot for like 50 yards, you know?
Yeah, it's just kind of it's a calculated guess at some point, you know?
And yeah, exactly.
The more, you know, it's just like a sniper. The more data you have in the bank, the better chance you got of making it. That's a hard shot, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, I shot my doll sheep in Alaska at a 55 degree slope at 46 yards, and that, I look back at that shot and I think, and the only reason I knew that is I'd gotten a book Kirk Etheridge had written at the time, and he had a cut chart in there. It's the first time I ever seen anything about cut charts, so I just laminated it and stuck it in my pack,
mm-hmm.
and I had an angle meter, And so I was on this cliff above him, and I angled him, and man, that shot was tough. And I just shot him for like 23 yards, which is kind of, I just kind of run the charts out, you know, graduated him out to where I thought. But again, if I look back at that shot, I actually hit higher than I was actually aiming. But I mean, I probably hit him where I was supposed to, right under the backbone and down through. You know, I probably hit 5 or 6 inches higher than I was aiming.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I two nights later, I was faced with a very similar shot. My holdover was about the same, 30-something, 32, and the line of sight was just under 70. Mm-hmm. You know, not quite as steep. But I feel I would have hit this one, but I had a really crappy window of, like, I was shooting through some cedars. And I even radioed down to my guys that were spotting for me. I'm like, Jake, I'm gonna freaking hit this branch. I can see the arrow trajectory. It's gonna hit this branch. Sure enough, I clipped the freaking branch. The arrow got sideways and it hit him sideways, basically.
Like, slapped him.
Yep, slapped him. He went running off. Yeah, it was sad. I had to cut that trip short. I only had 6.5 days to hunt. I didn't hunt the full 15, but.
Well, that's what I hear from guys that go down there, you know. And I had one of my staff guys killed a heck of a ibex down there, and it's all long shooting, difficult shooting. You know, if I was training to go from there, I would take my bow out, I'd create a cut chart. I would know, you know, right now I have only one cut chart, and everybody wants my cut chart, but they don't realize that cut chart's only good at the speed I shoot it at.
Right.
And so when you start getting, you know, it's just like a rangefinder. When I made that doll sheep shot, it's only 46 yards. So yes, I missed, but the miss is still a kill. So
yeah.
Most people that do that in that scenario, 90% of whitetail hunters, you know, they didn't miss far enough to worry about it. So they never really search out the answer. Whereas in target archery, you're shooting 3-4 arrows, you better start searching out the answer, because these tournaments are decided by, you know, a couple points.
Yep.
And but I love that kind of shooting, because it's just it's all what you call expertise. You know, it's like the guys that built the G7 rangefinder for rifles. You know, they realized that there was a deficiency in cosine cuts, and you know, they went about correcting the problem. So, best products in archery are always fixes to existing products. You know.
Right. They need to come out with that. With that range for type of rangefinder for archery, put in your speed.
Well,
and
you know, I'm thinking it'll come eventually. My personal belief is that it'll probably, you know, we're part of Bushnell with the Vista Outdoors. I'm trying to get them to do something with it, but you know, who knows? Leopold seems to, you know, be the ones that pay attention the most, it seems like, to the archery people, you know.
Yeah.
and the tournament guides especially, is, you know, and that's where it's going to come from. I mean, you know, those G7 rangefinder stuff didn't come from guys that are just shooting hunting. It came from guys that wanted to shoot long distance stuff and perfect it, you know, so snipers and guys like that, you know.
Yeah, for sure. So. For sure.
I mean, they can put ballistic missile at 200 miles in your window. They can sure figure out how to make a rangefinder read perfectly accurate. You know, I may not, I don't know all the engineering behind it, but I can go out and grind it out on a hill and, you know, walk up and down a 35-degree slope for 2 hours and you know, shoot my slopes in and make my own graduation charts, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's fine if you got the time. There's a lot of, with the ibex, you just don't have the time. Very, very rarely do you have a really, like, you know, where it's a mule deer and it's bedded down and, you know, you can range it and you can adjust your sight and take a second and count yourself through your steps. This is kind of like a freaking drive-by shooting, you know. So it's kind of hardy. I think even if I had a chart, I mean, I knew it was like draw back, take a shot, or you're not going to get the shot off type scenario.
Right.
I heard they can see
like no other. I mean,
it's ridiculous. You know how antelope can see really long distances and stuff like that?
Yeah.
They have no tolerance, nothing. They see a I mean, one of them, you know, they're in a group together. You're watching them from 900 yards away. One of them kicks a rock by accident, and they all freaking, like, get spooky. It's like, you know, it's really crazy. That's why I love them so much. I definitely want
to. I would think after hearing about guys hunting them that the best way to hunt them would be to learn their escape routes and just bump them.
Yep.
But,
guys do that a lot. There's a that's a tactic. If you got enough guys, you can do they call them goat herders. you can get guys to bump them and kind of get them come past you. But even that's not
I'm sure.
It definitely helps, but that makes it even more of a drive-by. So when you bump them, they don't just, like, go, like, 150, 200 yards, whatever, 300 yards. They'll go into, like, the next county if they could.
Oh, really?
They're a super interesting animal. I think anybody that spends a lot of time hunting them, it would definitely make you a much better hunter for everything else.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I got a little cocky afterwards because, like, I'm like, I could kill an ibex. I could kill this thing.
I killed a coos deer on the first stock. Come on, right there.
There you go. Well, that's it, too. So coos deer, like, for me, I think in the hierarchy, they're right behind, I mean, not closely behind, but my next step, I think, is coos deer. Coos deer are a tough freaking animal to, spot and stalk. But, I think anybody does coos deer with a bow that's not sitting on water or whatever, because, that's a different scenario. It's a more controlled situation. But spot and stalk on a coos deer is tough.
Fast. I mean, it's just, amazing how fast they are.
Yep. They react. If you're not shooting a fast bow, that's an animal that will duck your arrow quick.
Yeah, next time I go coos deer hunting, I will specifically set my arrow up for coos deer, and that means low profile veins, very little offset in them, and a broadhead that I actually was thinking about getting some of these Night Fury broadheads that Muddy makes just for coos deer because they're so low blade surface area. They're similar to like the old Gladiators we used to sell, but they look like they would just fly as silent as can be, and create very little, you need very little vein to actually, to steer them.
Right.
And in that scenario, I mean, that's kind of what you're dealing with. I mean, the animals jump the sound of the arrow coming at them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the advantages of shooting mechanicals is the fact that you can use less vein and create less noise signature coming at the animal. So.
Yeah. I remember you and I talked about that several years ago when I had you on the podcast, and I've actually brought that up a lot because, people always talk about jumping the string, and then, you brought that up to me, and I ended up looking into it afterwards, too, is that they're actually jumping the arrow, the sound of the arrow cloving through the air, than the actual string. So.
The guy that first brought that to my attention was Steve Cobreen, and Steve Cobreen's probably killed more animals, SCI animals, than anybody in the world. In Africa, I mean, that guy's a beast, and he was filming impala, and he would film shooting into a target behind him and film shooting at him, and it was like a 100% different reaction.
Yeah.
And so impala are a lot like coos deer in the way they react. I mean,
yeah.
Just
black buck are like that, too. Have you ever gone shoot a black buck?
No,
even like, even
never,
in like
never.
Texas?
Never have.
Those guys they'll jump straight up and they'll flatten out legs forward and legs back. Like they become like this horizontal line when you shoot at them. And if you're not shooting a fast arrow.
Yeah. I mean, and there's, that's another scenario where streamlining that arrow, and just creating less air push is less noise, And, if you could take a Pierce Platinum and put a deep six broadhead in it with a hit insert and put a 1.8 target vein on there, you'd never be able to see it fly, but shoot it at Mach 10 out of a quiet bow, next time I go coos deer hunting, I'll be shooting some heat. I mean, I think I was shooting 315, 320 when I went down there on that hunt, and that thing still was, it was ridiculous.
Yep.
What he did, but.
Yeah, and then there's guys like Fred Eichler shooting him with a Hoyt Buffalo, and still knocking them down. It's just all, you know, it's weird. It's a
Well, I mean, you know, if an arrow's moving slower too, it doesn't create as much noise either.
No, that's true. That's
you know,
true.
Quite as much. So, you know, there's trade-offs in every scenario. I mean,
yeah.
But you know, in order for me to shoot fixed blades, I got to put four big blazer-style vanes on, or you know, two 2.8 VaneTech Swifts or something like that. And I mean, that creates a lot more noise. I mean, I had an elk bed head down feeding, completely dodged the arrow, and I was just like, huh? An elk?
That's crazy.
I mean, you just don't hear that about elk, you know?
No.
So
I've never had an elk even twitch.
Yeah. So
that's crazy.
Maybe just my bad luck.
Yeah, I'd say you got some pretty good luck, man. So, all right. Well, I want to thank you for coming on and you know, sharing your expertise with us.
No problem. Anytime. I enjoyed it.
All right. Well, I'll be talking to you soon. I gotta get my arrow set up here coming for the 2017 season.
Mm-hmm. Well, go ahead.
Sorry. I'm going to be shooting. I'm probably going to be shooting the Halon 32, so
mm-hmm.
It's not going to be too much different than with the same 6-inch brace height. So I don't know if it's going to be too much of a different setup,
right.
But we'll see.
Well, we have a new Pierce Tour shaft. It's designed for target archery. You'll see across the board, you're going to see the Pierce shaft improve a lot this year. We went to a new process on that shaft that we're trying to perfect with that shaft, and we're going to try to start moving it into some of the other lines. But it's giving us much, much higher straightness yields. I think you'll see the straightness tolerances increase. The Pierce shaft is going to be sorted with a laser machine that has three lasers on it rather than, you know, the one that, you know, is AMO standard. And it creates it's a much better sorting process. We're seeing much better results out of it. So even the Pierce Platinums, I think you're going to see a dramatic increase this year. Keep in mind when all the gold tip shafts are weight coated, you know, so
mm-hmm.
if you want to be a serious long range shooter with a bow, you got to pay attention to all those little details. And,
yeah.
You know, the weight codes are on the shafts when you get them, and it allows the shooter to match them. You know, it's just like reloading ammo for a gun. You can buy a certain level of accuracy. You have to create the next level. So,
right.
Our customer service team here, you know, I work with them. You know, they're really good guys. I mean, they know a lot. So don't be afraid to have anybody call in and you know, talk setups. I mean, we've got myself here. We got Kevin Wilkie here, who's a world champion archer. And plus the other guys that work here as in-house sales and customer service, you know, they're inundated with this, and they do it, you know, all the time too. So they, you know, they learn what we know. So.
Exactly. Well, thank you again. And like I said, I'll be talking to you soon. Next time you come down to Arizona, let me know. I'd like to, take you out and get you some, get some hunting in for you. I know you got some guys over here like Brian and stuff, so, but.
Sure. Yeah, I go down and hunt with Matt Cutlip, you know, he's a good friend of mine, and I've got a couple of the guys on staff. I got one of my guys that's a Border Patrol guy down in Arizona, and so he gets to scout deer all day, every day.
Yeah.
So, a
good
guy. He kills some nice coos deer with a bow every year. So. All right, John. Well, I appreciate you having me on, and good luck on your rest of your year.
Thank you. You too.